to both counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move to our second case this morning, and it is Reed versus Brex Inc. All right, can you hear me?
Mark Potashnik for the plaintiffs, yes.
All right, then we'll proceed. Mr. Potashnik, you may go ahead with your argument.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Summary judgment was granted against us in the district court in favor of the party with the burden of proof. We believe that summary judgment was one based on failure to apply the Seventh Circuit's applicable standard and factors, two, failure to consider evidence of record that was material to decision of the claims, and third, failure to give us the benefit of reasonable inferences. When the summary judgment motion movement has the burden of proof, they have to show that the record is so one-sided as to rule out the possibility of finding for the other side, even when there's zero opposition filed to that motion. We do not believe the defendants came close to that. Issue number one is, does Brex or the defendants have bona fide commission pay plans? There's four factors that were set forth by this court in Yee and Alvarado and summarized in cases like Dial within the circuit and cases outside the circuit. The Seventh Circuit recognizes that bona fide commissions are usually a percentage or proportion of the ultimate price passed on to the customer. Here, the evidence in the record shows that it's not a set percentage, and it varies widely from about 9% to 65%. To explain...
Can I ask you a question about the way you're framing this argument and the evidence that you're relying on? As I understand it, we are seeing some factual arguments that were not presented to the district court. Mike, I don't know whether that's correct, but I'd like you to address it. And I, in particular, the way you're framing this argument in terms of the district court having a duty to consider all of the evidence of record, I had understood the district judge's obligation to be to consider the evidence cited by the parties in their briefs in the district court, not to undertake a free-ranging search of that record to see if there might be genuine issues of material fact somewhere in there.
Well, if in Hotel 71, Mez Lender versus National Retirement Fund and Johnson versus Gunmanson, they say that even if there's no opposition filed, there's still a duty on the district court to determine whether the summary judgment record itself reveals a genuine issue of material fact.
I understand that. Do I understand correctly that your theory is that the district judge was obligated to do the kinds of calculations that you have presented to us on appeal, even though they were not presented to the district judge? For example, showing the variations in the percentage of sales and the inverse correlations at times between hours and pay.
I believe so under the Seventh Circuit's rule, not just to take the defendant's representation without testing it based on evidence that was there, that the pay comes out to 16 to 17%.
District judges are busy. Why couldn't Judge Rosenstengel count on you to present those arguments in the district court?
Well, in all candor, 2020 being hindsight, I wish I had. But we thought it was an obvious matter. So secondly, they were arguing that their pay plan provide 16 to 17% commissions, not that their pay records provide 16 to 17% commissions. We did argue in the district court that part of the pay comes from tire installations, which is obviously not a commission and a piece rate. We did argue in the district court that part of the pay comes from hourly pay for based on automotive certifications, which is not commissions. We argued those two things, and you know the natural impact of those two arguments is that it's not going to come out as 16 to 17% of sales are pay or commission. I mean, that's just a natural thing. I mean, we didn't take the extra step and do all the math, but we did argue that this pay plan has major components that are not commissions. But getting back to my point, you know, we did argue that this is an hourly pay plan, also based on the pay plan documents which are given to employees, which show hourly pay. They're phrased in terms of statements like technicians will be compensated hourly based on their sales production. I mean, that shows less commissions. Clearly, there are many remarks like that in the pay plan documents. We showed their advertisements to prospective technicians, which say, we have the best technician hourly pay plan reward that rewards top producers up to $50 per hour. We showed many admissions through the depositions, through their top management, that pay depends on hours work. If hours work is a factor in determining pay, and hours work is a variable in determining pay, that all clearly shows that we're not talking about commissions, we're talking about hourly pay, or in the case of the tire installations.
Hello. Mr. Potashnik?
I think we've lost him.
Yeah, Mr. Potashnik, I think we've lost you. Can you hear us? If you have audio, perhaps turn off your video camera and just use the audio. Can you hear us?
We're going to try and get him reconnected.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello, we can hear you. We can't see you, but I think everyone can hear you. Judge Hamilton, Judge Brennan?
Yes.
Yes. All right.
Okay, Mr. Slade, you can hear, you can nod. Yes, okay. Yes. Everyone can hear you, Mr. Potashnik. You may proceed.
Sorry about that. I just don't know what happened. I was saying that we're entitled to the reasonable benefit of the of any doubts as to this evidence that repeatedly shows an hourly pay plan. What we got, I don't think is the reasonable benefit of those inferences, because the district court determined that these repeated statements in the pay plans, in the advertisements, in the depositions about hourly pay or hours determining pay mean the exact opposite of what is said on the documents and in the depositions. As to the Seventh Circuit's third factor, the type of work is such that the peculiar conditions do not lend to the work to a standard 8-hour workday. There's no showing of that. Again, it was the defendant's burden to prove that. There's no showing that the workers can't be scheduled to 8-hour shifts. There's no showing of seasonality. The only evidence in the record is our expert report, which examined their business records and showed no seasonality. The fourth factor is, does the pay plan offend the purposes of the FLSA? Well, the cases from this court, such as Alvarado and Yee, recognize that this exemption was intended when there's irregular hours or seasonality, but there's still about 2,000 hours per year worked. To the contrary, the defendant's own pay records that we presented to the district court show that the average automotive technician works more than 2,500 hours for them. Some work close to 3,000 hours a year. And years, full years with less than 2,000 hours are extremely rare. That happened in three out of the 150 examples that we have. Issue two here is, does Brex comply with the 50% rule, which in this case can be characterized as, you know, to comply with that rule, does there have to be a reconciliation between pay and commission percentages? Well, there, you know, there's the cases we cited, Tillis and Keyes, which find lack of qualification for the 7i exemption, that say, yes, there does have to be such periodic reconciliation. But there's also several of the cases cited by the defendants, which say the same thing. Crawford, McInnish, Lee, Gordon, in these cases, they rely on the fact that there was periodic settlement against a drawer commission to determine that these are bona fide commissions, or that the 50% rule has been satisfied. The regulation itself is 29 CFR 779-416B, which speaks in terms of a guarantee or draw against commission that will qualify for exemption provided the other conditions of the 7i exemption are met. In cases such as McInnish, cited by the defendant, it recognizes that, quote, defendant's compensation plan requires periodic settlement, comma, an aspect of a straight commission with a draw plan noted in the regulation, end quote. That's telling as to whether there has to be reconciliation here. The DOL handbook also indicates strongly that there has to be reconciliation, and the DOL handbook is entitled to judicial deference. Now, the district court appears to have been the first court to reject the idea of reconciliation, but without reconciliation between minimum pay and a commission percentage, the only way you're going to have proportionality that the Seventh Circuit identifies as a major factor of what's a commission is if you have an occasional stroke of luck that the percentages just worked out. Issue three, again, there's just too many hours here to fulfill the burden of, or to fulfill the purpose of the exemption and the FLSA. You know, Dial versus Piritano, decided within the circuit, recognized jury questions in strikingly similar situations, including what provides incentives, whether the pay system was in fact commission-based, whether the pay system furthered the purposes of the FLSA. These are all the same jury questions or questions of fact that we seek to present to the jury, and that should have been allowed to go to a jury. The district court came up with a new test for the 50% rule with three factors: the frequency of how often the guarantee is provided, the extent to which the guarantee exceeds earned commissions, and where available information as to common practice in the relevant industry. The problems with this test are it's unsupported. It conflicts with the Seventh Circuit's factors from both Yee and Alvarado. It seeks to base compliance on industry custom, which has been repeatedly rejected, including by the Supreme Court in Barentine versus Arkansas Best Freight. The district court found that the guaranteed minimum pay is small in applying this odd test, but it only considered the minimum pay to be the amount above commissions. That's different than the way it was done in Keyes versus Car X. That's the opposite. And Keyes versus Car X is the most analogous pay plan out there, in which it was found that there was no qualification for the 7i exemption. It's the opposite of what Gordon recently did in a case cited by the defense, which found that all minimum pay was considered to be unlike commission. And it's also based on comparison to 16 to 17% of sales, apparently. And we've shown that sales pay as a percentage of sales dips as low as 9%. So even though this is an improper test, we also believe that the district court improperly applied that test. And for one additional reason also, they said that minimum pay is provided a small percentage of the time. Well, the pay records itself, which the district court obviously did look at in making that conclusion, show that minimum pay is paid to about one out of every six technicians each week. If that's the math is carried out, that's about 750 times a year. I cite a case from Northern District of Iowa, Buofaccio versus Tyson Foods, 2011 U.S. District Lexus 86437, which says, in looking at the de minimis exception, that yes, it's a few minutes of unpaid time each day per employee, but consider this in the aggregate, it's sizable. Giving minimum pay to one out of six automotive technicians every week turns out to be a sizable amount. The defense has advocated for the smell test, and that's just a completely different test than the Seventh Circuit factors set out in Yee and Alvarado. It's much easier to meet the requirements of that test. All the employer has to show is absence of an overt sham. And I cannot see, because I lost contact, how much time is left.
You have about 3 minutes and 45 seconds. So if you would like to reserve, you should do so now.
Yes, please. Sorry I didn't do that before. I can't see.
That's fine. Understood.
Okay.
All right. We'll move to Mr. Slade.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Randall Slade on behalf of the defendants, Appellees, Rex Inc., Kevin Floyd, and John Keeley. Your Honors, I'd like to start by addressing something counsel raised. He has argued that in this case, the actual commissions are not proportional. Now, as counsel has admitted, this is not an argument he raised to the district court. And in fact, his response shows why district court the arguments need to be made to the district court. In this particular case, we've been prejudiced because the evidence in the record below is not developed, and there is an explanation, a very simple explanation for why the plaintiff has made this argument showing a 9 to 65%, I believe was his claim. Now, the Brex pay plan has essentially four components. The first component and the biggest component that determines technician pay is their hourly production scale. And the word hourly there is a bit of red herring. The district court pointed out that context is important in all these cases, but what it's really about is sales production. Each sale to a customer, excluding tire sales, fees, and LPSG revenue, is credited to the salesman, and that salesman will, or technician, excuse me, will receive 15 to 17% based on how that's according to their scale. So how this happens is the sales are measured, the technician's hours are measured, and then at the end of the week, you can determine their hourly sales production, which then goes into the scale, which gives you an hourly rate for that technician, which is based solely on their sales production for those matters. And this, the only way the technician earns more is by producing more. If the technician works more but doesn't produce more, the pay is unaffected. And we have some examples in our brief showing the math for that. So that's the sales Slade, production.
Mr. Slade, what should we do then with all of the documents in the record that calculate hourly rates for technicians under this pay plan?
Well, I think how we'd explain that is an hourly rate is, as it's used in the context of this statute, an hourly pay plan is one where the sum is stipulated in advance between the employee and the employer. In other words, an employee says, the employer says, I'm going to pay you $15 an hour to do this work. And the employee shows up, he knows if he works an 8-hour day, that's $120 in his pocket. Under our pay plan, the Brex pay plan, pay is driven by production. The technician knows at the beginning of the day that his
I understand your perspective. I guess what I'm trying to ask you to do is address under the summary judgment standard, the fact that so many documents seem to be phrased in terms of calculating hourly rates.
And I think the what the district court addressed that is said it was context is important. Any term can be expressed as an hourly rate. In this case, Brex has chose to express the pay plan in terms of an hourly rate as essentially a way to attract technicians, as it was their experience that technicians had a better understanding or experience of hourly pay compared to strict percentages. So I think what's important, though, and what the case law really suggests you need to do is get under the hood and see, no pun intended, and see how exactly the pay plan is driven. What puts the money in the pocket of the technicians? And in this case, it's not an agreement between the employer and the employee that they're going to make a certain stipulated sum of money per hour. It's an agreement that their pay will be based upon their sales production, how much they produce in sales for that given day. And that is converted to an hourly rate, but any pay system where hours are recorded and hours have to be recorded here for purposes of compliance with the FLSA, that pay plan can be expressed in an hourly fashion. But what really sets this as a commission is the fact that the technicians are receiving their 15 to 17% of whatever their sales are. Now, that does exclude tire sales, which is the next thing I wanted to get to. The other three components here include tire sales, LPSG revenue, and bonuses for certifications. Now, tires are a separate part of the calculation because tires are expensive, from one thing, and the amount of work involved in doing a tire change takes much less skill and work from the technician than the other things where they're getting 15, 16, 17% of their sales production. And so in this case, Brex's pay plan is $5 per unit from 1 to 7 units, $8.70 units and above. Now, this can really scramble the numbers because the numbers that the plaintiff is using to calculate that 9% to 65% that he claimed includes tire sales. It's not just the sales production for the matters of that where that sales production is 15, 16, 70%. So if you have a set of tires at $150 a tire, and the technician is selling $600 worth of tires for that, that gets added to that number that the plaintiff is using to claim that our pay plan is not proportional. Now, again, this is an argument that wasn't made below. So, we didn't have a chance to argue this in the district court. But essentially what plaintiff is doing is arguing that the application of the pay plan isn't consistent, where in fact, It is. It's all sales production is compensated based on the production scale. Tires at $5 per unit for 1 to 7 and $8.75 for 8 and above and then LPSG revenue at 5%. So that's how we account for that discrepancy. It's really driven by the tire sales and LPSG revenue and other factors that aren't considered sales production for purposes of the scale. Now, ultimately, as I've said, the fundamental driving force here behind the pay plan is sales production, which is what makes this a bona fide commission plan. We have a set percentage based on the scale for sales that is going into the technician's pocket. And we also have a system where the technician doesn't earn more by having more hours worked, but rather earns more by having more in sales production. And I think under the factors in Yi, that is really what makes this a commission plan. The fact that it's expressed as an hourly rate in certain areas in the marketing materials that the plaintiff relies on. I'd point out also that those marketing materials also say that compensation is going to be based on sales production. Compensation is a system is going to reward the top producers. And that's really the intent of this pay plan, is to identify the best technicians and pay them more than technicians that aren't as efficient. And that's a benefit to both Brex as a company, of course, because it means they can perform more repairs, and it's a benefit to these technicians because they'll get paid more. Now, the Yi case talks about decoupling pay from hours worked. And in this case, how that works is essentially we take the sales production and they divide it by hours simply for the purpose of the scale. It's not the hourly mathematical equation doesn't impact the ultimate compensation to that technician. It's simply a matter of a way of expressing it to the technician so they can see that the more they produce, their hourly rate of pay is going to increase. But that doesn't mean they're being paid hourly. That means they're still being paid on a commission basis consistent with Section 207I. Now, the second aspect of the Brex pay plan that is being contested in this appeal is the idea of a guarantee. Brex does provide a guarantee to its technicians of 1.5 times the wage. Section 207I directly states that guarantees are permissible. The last sentence of 207I says, in determining the proportion of compensation representing commissions, all earnings resulting from the application of a bona fide commission rate shall be deemed commission on goods or services without regard to whether the computed commissions exceeds the drawer guarantee. So they're expressly recognizing that a guarantee can be part of a bona fide commission system. The concept of a guarantee is also addressed in the DOL regulations, 29 CFR 779.416A, says guarantees keyed to a time base, which are normally smaller than expected commission earnings, can be part of a bona fide commission system. Now, as counsel for the plaintiffs pointed out, in this case, I believe on the plaintiff's math, the guarantee was paid in approximately 16% of work weeks. So you can see that in 84% of work weeks, Brex technicians were in fact exceeding the guarantee. This was a guarantee designed, first of all, to ensure compliance with the statute, which requires the regular rate of pay to be more than 1.5 times the applicable minimum wage. in practice, we see that it, in fact, is something that technicians are receiving only a small fraction of the time. Section 416A also explicitly states that reconciliation or deducting excess amount from the commission earnings in the future may or may not be customary. In other words, you can do it both ways. You can have reconciliation or you can not have reconciliation. I'd point out that for in if we consider the purposes of the FLSA, if one of the purposes of the FLSA is to benefit the workers, in this case, not having reconciliation is a benefit to the workers. If you have a reconciliation, you're essentially taking money out of the workers' pocket, which in this case, Brex does not do. They pay their guarantee, and then if the worker doesn't make that, doesn't meet the minimum for that particular week, the worker receives the guarantee. The following week, the technician does exceed the guarantee. Brex is not going to take that money back. And this is something that is permitted by the plain language of the statute and by the regulations, which I'm going through now. Now, Section 416B further drives home that point by saying, that all computed commissions will be counted as compensation representing commissions, even though the amount of commissions may not equal or exceed a guarantee or draw in some work weeks. The exemption will also apply in the case an employee is paid a fixed salary plus an additional amount of earned commissions if the amount of commission payments exceeds the total amount of salary payments for the representative period. Now, we don't believe that the guarantee qualifies as salary, but what that shows is that the in this case, everything that is computed under Brex's scale or under Brex's pay plan should be considered commission, but for any amounts that would be between the guarantee pay and whatever they earn as commission. In the Gordon case, they called it the differential pay. That's not a term Brex uses, but I think it's a fair representation of what limited amounts would not constitute in this case. Now, if we go through the two workers in this case, we've already discussed the fact that the guarantee was paid in 16% of weeks, work weeks, by plaintiff's own admission. Two plaintiffs here, Plaintiff Reed received the guarantee in 25% of his weeks, and 21% of his total pay comes from the guarantee. Plaintiff Roy received his, minimum in 33% of the weeks and 27.5% of his total pay. Another thing to that I think is worth pointing out is that the Brex's compensation system is designed to encourage technicians to work faster, to work more efficiently, so they can produce more and earn more for themselves as well as earn more for Brex. Now, if you look at the pay records in this case, it shows that during the beginning of their employment with Brex, both Reed and Roy received the guarantee much more often than they did towards the end of their employment with Brex. This is evidence essentially that they were becoming better workers, more efficient workers, as their time with Brex increased, and thus they were being paid more, had more money in their pockets after through the course of their system. And we think the pay plan is one of the reasons for that. Now, there are Section 416C lists two situations where commissions are not bona fide, neither apply in this case. The first is where technicians essentially are earning the same fixed amounts each week. This is clearly not the case here. The pay records in this case show significant variation in the compensation the technicians were receiving, both as a total amount as well as on a per hour basis. The second situation involves a regular payment constituting nearly the employee's entire earnings, expressed in terms of percentage of sale, with only a slight addition based upon a greatly reduced percentage applied to sales above the quota. In this case, we don't have a quota. Technicians receive the same percentage amount for each sale they made in terms of the sales production. So I want to address the cases plaintiff relied upon very quickly. The Tillis case, I'll point out that's distinctly factually different. In this case, our pay plan, the Brex pay plan, was put together, in fact, in conjunction with and following a Department of Labor audit. There has always been an intent to compensate technicians on a commission basis and also comply with the FLSA. in the Tillis case, which specifically noted that there was no guarantee in that case is one of the factors it considered. Whereas in this case, we are guaranteeing that we are going to comply with the statute by guaranteeing 1.5 times minimum wage. In that case, the theory of a of commission was essentially developed as after the lawsuit was filed. It was not something that the company had considered or made a factor in developing the pay plan, wherein is this case, Brex has always wanted to have a commission pay plan that complies with the FLSA. In the Keys case, one thing I would also note on that, and this applies to virtually every case cited by both parties in this case, the Keys case specifically notes that they're reading the statute under a narrow construction. In 2018, of course, the Supreme Court in Encino Motor Cars said that that's not the appropriate standard. Instead, the exemption should be given a fair reading. But regardless, in Keys, the district court found. Yes.
These are all unpublished district court opinions. We can safely ignore them.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. What I will say then, of course, is the Yee case is, of course, the Seventh Circuit case in this situation. And the two main driving things behind that decision were that the commission was a based on a proportion of sales. In this case, we have the sales production and the scale that Brex uses to compensate its technicians is targeting that 15 to 17% range. If you do the math, you can see it's consistent throughout the scale. So we have that factor. It's based on percentage of sales. Then we have the tire sales, which are based on $5 per unit LPSG, 5% of revenue. The tire sales and the LPSG revenue end up being a small fraction of the overall compensation. It's the biggest driving factor is sales production on things like brake jobs and transmissions and things of that nature. And of course, the second major factor in Yee is the idea that pay is decoupled from hours worked. In this case, I think that's it's when you look at how the pay is actually determined, you cannot increase your pay by working more hours. The only way you can increase your pay is by increasing your sales production. And given that that is the case here, we think the pay plan clearly complies with Section 7I and that summary judgment was properly granted. And I'm out of time. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Potashnik.
Yes, a few items in rebuttal here. They argue that tires are causing these big discrepancies that we're seeing, but there's no evidence of how much impact the tires had on the total commission percentages. There's just only counsel's assertion there. But what, you know, just to look at this mathematically, to show differences ranging wildly from 9% to 65%, the impact of the tires has to be substantial, and it has to be in both directions, both dragging the commission percentage, if you want to, if it could be called that, down and drag and lifting it up totally there too. But it was the defendant's burden to prove in the district court overall that there's that percentages are driving the pay, not other factors, and they did not do that. As to saying that an hourly rate has to be stipulated in advance, well, there's no legal support for that position, and a variable hourly rate is a recognized type of hourly rate. Both depend on hours to some extent.
Under Mr. Potashnik, under the formula that Brex uses, if two technicians are working do the same number of jobs, sales production over the week, and one works an extra 2 hours per day, what effect does that have on their net pay?
If they qualify for the commission, they're going to be the same. But, you know, what they're assuming is that pay doesn't depend on hours. Well, if you keep up the same pace over another 10 hours, you're going to be making a lot more. So hours do matter. Hours also matter whenever you don't get the commission. If you don't get the commission, you're looking at minimum pay, and that's just incentivizes working more hours. But either way, minimum wage or qualifying for what they call the commission and working more, you make more. The other thing to note there is, I'm sorry, lost my train of thought. Let me come back to that. The argument on reconciliation that they gave, I think, ignores the key federal regulation, which is 29 U.S.C. 779-416, which is right on point. Although the cases from outside the district are from outside the district, I think that they're all consistent and they're all persuasive.
Could you address the employer's point about reconciliation? Generally, is at the expense of employees.
Well, reconciliation may benefit employees in some situations. It may also hurt them. But it takes pay away from them later on if they later start to beat the threshold for a minimum. Sometimes that doesn't happen.
Thank you.
How is that helpful to the employee?
How is that helpful to the employee? It's not helpful to the employee, but reconciliation creates a consistent percentage which supports a finding of a commission which did not occur here. Does that answer the question?
Well, I understand Judge Hamilton. Question to be asking for a response to Mr. Slade's argument that a system that entails reconciliation actually leaves the employees worse off, which it does, unquestionably. You've answered that, yes.
Yes, I believe it does. It takes money away from them when they're doing better.
Right. Okay. I understood. Okay, and your time has expired, Mr. Panashnik. So we will conclude the argument there. The case is taken under advisement, and our thanks to both counsel.